Coco.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please.
Please wait till your adversaries get seated. Mr. Schoenfeld.
Sorry for jumping the gun there, Your Honor. May it please the court. Subject to the court's questions, I would like to focus on the reasons why the releases in this case are void as against public policy under the Supreme Court's decision in Roomery. We urged the district court, and we have urged this court in brief, to adopt the Third Circuit's two-prong test in this regard, under which, number one, as is an affirmative defense, the defense must establish that the civil rights claims appeared to be frivolous or marginal when viewed objectively, and number two, that the prosecutor was in fact motivated to obtain the releases because he or she thought that the civil rights claims appeared to be frivolous or marginal. I think that ties into a comment a statement in Justice O'Connor's concurring decision in Roomery, in which she said that one of the factors to consider was whether it was a legitimate criminal justice objective for obtaining releases. There is such an objective, a legitimate objective, when the civil rights claims look to be weak, extremely weak, or invalid. That objective disappears the stronger the civil rights claims appear to be, because we value the idea that meritorious civil rights claims are to be encouraged, and that is why I think that...
I'm not sure I understand the nature of this position. Of course, it was... The line you're taking now was rejected squarely by this circuit in Dye, but I don't see that I understand it at all. The more oomph the civil rights claim would have had if filed, the more the potential plaintiff can get for surrendering it. And your argument seems to be that if this claim has some potential merit and you get a lot in exchange for surrendering it, for example, the dismissal of plausible criminal charges, then you can get the same value a second time in court, in damages, in the suit. That doesn't seem sensible to me. If it's worth a lot and you get value already for it, why does it mean you get it a second time?
Well, first, Your Honor, I don't think that Dye directly addressed that. I think in Dye, the court talked about how this was in fact a mutual release, and it's clear in Dye that the court, my reading of Dye was the court thought that that civil rights claim was not only weak, but perhaps entirely frivolous. But to address...
The holding of Dye is that issue would not be examined. Dye expressly rejected the claim that the district court should probe to see whether it was a good claim, because, Dye said, that makes the release worthless. You end up relitigating the suit anyway. Right? That was the position taken by the plaintiff in Dye. It was cleanly rejected by the court. But in any event, my question is functional. We can always reconsider or revise Dye. I'm just asking why it's a good idea, that is, why it would be a good doctrine that says that if you've got a decent civil rights claim and you use that to get one benefit in the settlement, the dismissal of serious criminal charges, you can then keep that benefit and go on litigating. It sounds like having your cake and eating it too, as a matter of law.
Because in order to deter police misconduct in the future, we encourage meritorious civil rights claims. That's the basis of Section 1988 for fees.
That's where I'm lost. Put criminal charges to one side. Somebody has a potential 1983 claim, and he uses it to get money. The case is settled for, say, 10 cents on the dollar based on what the original plaintiff's claim was. In your view, it sounds like the plaintiff gets the 10 cents and then gets to litigate anyway because we encourage meritorious civil rights claims. But that can't be your position. So if instead of getting 10 cents on the dollar, you get value through the dismissal of serious criminal charges, why then can you come and litigate the claim? In either event, the claim has been settled in exchange for something of value to the potential plaintiff.
I think under the Supreme Court's decision in Roemer, Your Honor, we look to factors other than pure contract law. If we were dealing with just pure contract law, then I would have to agree with what you're saying, that if one receives value, which is an issue in this case, a different issue in this case by consideration, but in the hypothetical, if one receives value or consideration, one is not normally, absent the usual contract affirmative defenses, involuntary or duress or fraud, allowed to overturn it. But plainly, the Supreme Court, in saying that on a case-by-case basis, if a relief is against public policy, it will be voided, told us that these are not simple contract cases, that there are broader public policy implications involved. Now, an additional aspect of that which applies to this case is, which has been talked about in some of the other circuit cases, is when the prosecutor becomes motivated to protect private interest. Here, there is clear evidence that the prosecutor virtually turned the decision over to the arresting officers, the defendants in this case. The prosecutor admitted that on the merits, the charges against my client probably should have just been dismissed. But he went and he talked to the officers. What do you want to do? We want releases. He turns the decision over to the defendants, and that is plainly just protecting private interest. And that, separate and apart from the issues that...
issues that Judge Easterbrook talked about, what about the conditions of the signing of the release? Where did that take place?
I'm not sure I'm following your question, Your Honor.
Where were the releases signed?
Where were the...
In their lawyer's office?
I don't recall if that's in the record, Your Honor.
Well, I think it is my recollection.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm simply being honest.
But
my
point is that they were not uncounseled. There was not an overreaching. They weren't given either-or conditions, were they?
Either-or conditions?
Either sign the release or we'll go forward with the prosecution.
I don't believe that the record reflects that, no.
Well, you were talking about factors other than contract law. What I'm trying to get at is the conditions under which the releases were signed. It was not a coercive circumstance.
We have not claimed that it rises to the level of contractual coercion. No.
Or just the conditions. You were attempting to go beyond just contract law and look at some of the circumstances involved, and that's what I was trying to draw your attention to, that these were not coercive. These were handed to them in their lawyer's office, I'll assume that, in a situation where there was no duress or coercion, and they agreed to sign the release with lawyer present, or with being counseled by a lawyer.
That's correct, Your Honor, but again, I think that gets back to the distinction, respectfully, between contract law and Supreme Court saying that you've got to look at this, and there are public policy reasons for not allowing people, there are public policy reasons for voiding releases. Releases are settlements, and settlements are contracts, for voiding releases that criminal defendants enter into, which under other circumstances would be valid contracts. And I think we have those circumstances here in part plainly from the fact that the prosecutor took this route by his own admission as a consequence of talking to the police, arresting the police officer or the defendants here in a situation where, under the prosecutor's testimony, those charges probably should have just been dismissed. That is a violation of due process, a violation of public policy, because it undermines valid civil rights claims.
Thank you, Mr. Schultill.
Thank you.
Mr. DeBonis.
May it please this honorable court. The fundamental question which the appellee used in this case is whether the agreement was voluntary and not the product of overreaching. That is the centerpiece of the Supreme Court's plurality decision in Rumery. In Justice O'Connor's concurrence, she outlines six factors among many that could be taken into account that should be applied in deciding the touchstone issue. And one of the paragraphs upon which the court did agree in Rumery is this, and I quote, this is from page 4 of the LED second edition, because Rumery voluntarily waived his right to sue under section 1983, the public interest opposing involuntary waiver of constitutional rights is no reason to hold this agreement invalid. Moreover, we find that the possibility of coercion in the making of similar agreements insufficient by itself to justify a per se rule against release dismissal bargain. If there is such a reason, it must lie in some external public interest necessarily injured by release dismissal agreement. In applying that, Your Honor, Justice O'Connor went further, and among the factors were six: knowledge and experience of the criminal defendant. I would submit in this case we had a Chicago police officer who certainly knew the law and certainly was experienced in these matters. Secondly, the circumstances surrounding the execution of the agreement. As Judge Kaney pointed out during my adversary's argument, this was signed at the end of a long period of discovery and negotiation that ran something like 9 months, during which depositions were taken, and there was considerable back and forth between the prosecution and able defense counsel. Thirdly, the fact that the defendant was counseled by able counsel weighs heavily in favor of finding no coercion. Fourth, the nature of the charges. These are criminal charges. They can be charged as a felony. But at the same time, this is basically a scuffle between off-duty police and on-duty police, if I could use that term, in a city court. I would suggest that while these are important charges, they do not rise to the level of the kind of violent threat that we had in Dye, for example, where there was a gun involved, where a police dog was shot, and where there was an attempt to escape from a more serious felony. There are some legitimate criminal justice objectives, too, for the release. Another factor. The prosecution made no bones about the fact that both sides were police officers, and it had some interest in preserving both their careers, if that could be done. Plainly, the state has saved the chore of prosecuting the case, and put to rest is a matter which, in the constellation of criminal matters which the state has on its plate, is a fairly minor matter. The final one is whether the release was obtained by judicial supervision.
Fairly minor matter until it becomes an issue in a future excessive force lawsuit against any of those involved.
That's correct, Your Honor. We cannot say here that the presiding judge of the city court was asked to approve this release, but nevertheless, the record shows that the release was executed in the court on the day set for the trial or disposition of the case. By that time, counsel for both sides had more or less reached agreement after having taken discovery. And what we must keep in mind is that the plaintiff in this case, the defendant in the city court, wanted this agreement very much. This is not something that was foisted upon him and his fellow defendant in that case during an interrogation where somebody shoves a release form in front of them. This was something bargained for, requested. Mr. Cray, the prosecutor, testified that Mr. Schlesinger, the criminal defense attorney who represented the parties, offered it right up front because Schlesinger had filed the notice of tort claim for the very purpose of giving himself some bargaining leverage. Even if we don't credit his testimony and credit Mr. Schlesinger made it clear, as the criminal defense attorney, that he was willing to give the releases and that it was a primary concern of his clients, particularly Mr. Gonzalez, to make sure this didn't affect his career as a police officer. I would submit that basic elements of equity much less contract law, require that that agreement be given effect. If we look at the arrest itself, there is no question that there is a conflict in the evidence. But I do think that there is sufficient evidence here which would have given the prosecutor an objective chance to make a case on these crimes in court. There was testimony by one of the officers that there was a request to be quiet after Gonzalez shouted. There is difference among counsel's interpretation of whether that yelling at the top of the voice or not, but we think a trier of fact would have been necessary to resolve that issue. And if that's the case, then the criminal claim was colorably good. And I would suggest under this court's formulation in Keon versus Couts that the police officers have probable cause to arrest, because at the moment the decision is made, the facts and circumstances within their knowledge and of which they had reasonably trustworthy information would warrant a prudent person in believing that they had committed or were committing an offense. The lady involved here in Holland interposed herself, tried to drag her boyfriend away forcibly, could not be restrained and had to be taken to the ground. We submit, Your Honors, that that was enough not only to make probable cause, it was enough to kill the 1983 action. It was certainly enough to make Mr. Gonzalez believe that he got a good deal by getting a dismissal and saving his career. We believe for all these reasons that this agreement was not void for public policy and is entitled to be enforced. We ask that you affirm the decision of the district court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. DeBonis. Anything further, Mr. Schoenfield?
I'll try to make several points quickly. First, in the Dye case, there was nothing to indicate the prosecutor was just out to protect private interest. Second, with regard to the statements about the evidence in this case, there is no evidence that Ms. Holland tried to drag Mr. Gonzalez away forcibly. That is not in the record. There was no yelling or noise by Ms. Holland. The brief yelling by Mr. Gonzalez, I would suggest to you, with both, as I did in the brief, with both political speech and not in violation in any of them. Finally, and very briefly, Your Honor, if this was just a matter of voluntariness and bargaining, it would be contract law.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement. Our final